everybody. Welcome to New Rhymes, especially in Pullers. We'd like to turn you all around the world up with your age of the sort of a fantastic fact. Has everyone got a rapid signal?
No.
Right, this is a subject that's not going to go away at all. The events of 9/11 are not just comprised in the structure of property and local loss of life. No one's inconsistency in the evidence put forward by the state begs the question why, and the answers are really, really slow to come. The repercussions of this state atrocity are resonating around the world in the form of war, restriction in movement and freedom, and the surveillance mentality. Tonight's speaker brings scientific evidence and observances of the latest survey. So strap yourselves in with Mr. Andrew Johnston.
All right, thanks. Right, thank you very much, everyone. Have a quick swig of tea. I'm pleased to see such a good turnout tonight. So I'm very pleased to be here speaking with you. There's going to be some quite interesting information, some revelations tonight. And I think you're going to go away with quite a lot to think about. So here we go. I hope we're free of technical hitches now. I actually lent the projector to somebody. This is my projector, and they'd set it into reverse, and I didn't know how to set it back, so that was a bit embarrassing, but there you go.
In the Council of Government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by tasking in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
So you all knew who that was from the caption. And I think those words, certainly the first section there, most people have heard, but the second section is less familiar to most people. And I think it's just as relevant. And I think you're going to see some of the results tonight of the extremes to which we are the captives of the scientific technological elite to a far, far greater extent than most people would be willing to accept. And I'm going to show the evidence for that tonight. To acquire knowledge, one must study, but to acquire wisdom, one must observe. And I haven't encountered anybody who's better at observing things than somebody called Dr. Judy Wood. But that was written by Marilyn Vos Savant, a writer. Okay, so tonight I'm going to look at some preliminary 9/11 truth issues. How many people have sort of had some dealings with 9/11 truth? Just, you know, how many have looked at the evidence that it was an inside job, which it was? Yeah, so over half then. Yeah, okay. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my initial involvement with 9/11 truth activities and how I became involved with the 9/11 Scholars Group, which is kind of one of the centrepieces. At the back there, I've got a lot of booklets and articles. Please take them, make a donation. I've got a couple of guys there, Steve and Steve, helping out, so thanks very much for that. To back up what I'm saying, You'll also see it on the website. I've got that on. The leaflets are free. Please take the leaflets. You know, I'm giving you a lot of information tonight. And I might have to skip over some things because I've probably tried to put too much in. So I do make apologies for that already. We're going to look at evidence for media fakery on and before 9/11. Evidence which indicates there were no large bombings at the World Trade Center, which is one of the big controversial topics in 9/11. Evidence for the use of some type of directed energy weapon, that's DEW, being used to destroy most of the World Trade Center complex, if not all of it. Links between the energy cover-up and the 9/11 cover-up. And evidence that there is an active and ongoing effort to cover up and discredit research into DEW and no planes and some of those individuals undertaking this activity. And I've got all that evidence back there and some of it in here too. And additional 9/11 related evidence and issues which you'll find most surprising. Now, I'll start off by saying I used to believe the official story up until about 2003. It was about, I think, late 2003 where I'd read a couple of articles about something called state-sponsored terrorism. And, you know, when I heard these stories, I remember hearing stories on the BBC of these hijackers turning up alive, and I thought, it must be some mess up. You know, these reporters get things wrong sometimes, so it must be just that. And I didn't really think about it. Over time, however, like most of us here, I've learned about how governments lie to a far greater extent than even heavy-hitting investigative journalists such as John Pilger, Greg Palast, etc., are willing to state publicly. People like John Pilger, you know, a very, very good journalist. What's he said about 9/11? Zip, to my knowledge. And governments have a history of being involved in false flag terrorism. Up until September the 11th, my understanding is that the scale of these false flag attacks was small and was generally restricted to things like diplomatic embassies and countries where conflicts were already in progress, such as Afghanistan and places like that. September the 11th was very much different. In fact, I would challenge you by the end of this presentation to say that it was even much more different than you've thought up to now, for those who haven't already seen some of the stuff that I'm presenting tonight. We know 9/11 was a big illusion. Well, most of us here would agree with that, I think, judging by the show of hands I had. How do you find out the extent of the deception? Are there layers of deception set up and managed by the perpetrators to hide the truth for as long as possible? I would never have thought of it like that up until maybe the last just over a year or two. Can those of us who know that World Trade Centers 1, 2 and 7 were not destroyed by planes, jet fuel and gravity have been fooled more than once? Perhaps it is unsettling to consider that the answer to that question might be yes. In fact, I would say categorically from where I'm standing, it is a paramount yes. Seeing the illusion. I don't know who's seen this picture before, but I'm going to point out something about it. It's a nice lakeside scene, you know, quite peaceful, quite interesting, a bit arty. Probably it's not a real picture, but you know, nice painting or something. So we go on. Once something has been pointed out, you can't help but see it. Perhaps you never saw the shape of the baby in the picture. Here's the baby. There's its head, its nose, and there's its foot. Okay? So I've really just shown this to say once you saw it, you remember it. You remember this picture now, and it will almost be impossible for you to look at the picture again without seeing the picture of the baby once you've become familiar enough with it. In other words, once you've seen the pattern in the data, that picture is data, a new picture emerges. In other words, initially it was just a lakeside scene with some trees, but now you see the picture of the baby and there's more information in that picture than you initially realised. That's my point. So how do we find the truth? How do we know what's true and what isn't true? In order to find the truth of something, we should spend as much time as we can gathering information, and I'm going to repeat this several times throughout this presentation because it's a key concept that I'm trying to get across. Examining pertinent evidence, okay? Before deciding on some conclusions. Most people have only examined the hijacker story and what they've been told on the news. So hijacker's done it. End of story. Don't think any more. I have been attempting myself to collect information and evidence related to 9/11 since about August 2004, and some of my initial conclusions have changed substantially on seeing new evidence. And I make a simple parallel here with court cases, for example. Court cases, investigations, etc., are sometimes reopened and appeals are initiated when new evidence comes to light. And that's what I'm going to be showing some of you tonight who have not already seen some of the stuff that I brought with me. It's the new evidence. You always have to be on the lookout for new evidence. And if you don't look at it, you won't find the truth. We can establish what did not happen. By studying the evidence carefully, we can have a better chance of saying certainly what did not happen, even if we can't always say exactly what did happen. In some cases, laws of physics can be used to establish what cannot and cannot have happened. We can check the consistency of a set of evidence to see if it obeys scientific laws, which we know are consistent through experiment. This includes things like the law of gravity, and also the properties of materials that will come up soon, hardness and softness. Is one material harder than another? Does one material turn to a dust suddenly for no reason when you set fire to it? People who are not familiar with physical laws and how they dictate what is not is and is not possible in our 3D physical reality can more easily be fooled by illusions. People who are familiar with physical laws can also be fooled, as I was for 3 years. Now, my background is actually in software engineering. I worked in software engineering for about 20 years. That's writing computer programs, designing computer programs. So one of the things I had to do was process a lot of technical information and come up with some solutions to a problem, which is really these sorts of skills are quite useful in doing this sort of research. Software engineering, you have to be a bit of a detective, and you also have to be quite creative in your thinking. And if you come to a brick wall and you've got somebody expecting you to solve the problem, you have to either work a way of knocking through the brick wall, climbing over it, or going round it. So that's where my background is. I don't do much programming anymore. They tend to want young graduates, but I still do bits and pieces. So I was fooled for 3 years because I didn't look at the evidence. That's why I was fooled. People who don't take time to look at the evidence will be fooled, and others who don't want to see the implications will just go into denial, and we experience that all the time. And the other thing that I'd like to bring out tonight, because I'm going to be talking about some people as well as what happened on 9/11, is the importance of studying people's history and behaviour. As well as evidence of physical events, witness testimony and behaviour are also important, or is also important. The actions of those studying and presenting the evidence should also be continually scrutinised so that a track record can be built up. You've got to do your own intelligence in this game, because there's a lot at stake and a lot of forces are working against you finding the truth. So I apply that to myself. Go and check me out. Come and ask me a question. I'll answer any question that I can. Okay? About me, my history, where I've come from, where I grew up. You can ask me anything. I don't mind. Now, what you should watch for carefully, particularly with what's going on with some of the stuff that I've been doing, is when one person starts to attack another and the way that that attack is made and done and orchestrated. So I have a friend in the audience and he says, watch out for them playing the man, not the ball. That's a good way of putting it. So you've got to look at the data. Forget all the distraction of name calling. This person is, is just silly, or they're stupid, or what they're saying is stupid. Check it for yourself. Now, a couple of things here. Most of the photos I'm going to show tonight have come from Dr. Judy Wood. Dr. Judy Wood is probably the person who's done the most research into 9/11 of anyone. She has looked at about probably 10 or 15,000 different photographs, mainly from the World Trade Center, which has been the focus of her study, which I think reveals most of the larger secrets that I want to talk about tonight. And she's posted these pictures on her website. A lot of people attack these pictures, but they tell their own story. And it's rather that different to that than in most of the books, the Griffin books and the Tarpley books. It's very much different to the story to what's told in those. Some people think that NIST have kept all the interesting photos and videos of 9/11 for themselves. Well, if that was true, I wouldn't have them with me tonight to show you, would I? So we can debunk that one straight away, or by the end of tonight I'll have debunked it. So I just want to make some acknowledgements here. I want to, top of the list is Dr. Judy Wood. I'll mention her name probably a few times. Dr. Morgan Reynolds, I also have to acknowledge what he's been doing. People like Rosalie Grable, who goes under the pseudonym of Web Fairy, done a lot of work on the video fakery. She was one of the early people to come up with the research about the planes hitting the World Trade Center. Other No Planes researchers, even though some of them have tended to adopt a more adversarial stance, shall I say, against various people mentioned here, including me. They have collected the evidence and stood by an analysis of it as individuals rather than a group. That, I think, is also important. I'd just like to make it clear, I don't speak for Morgan Reynolds, I don't speak for Judy Wood, I don't speak for any group, I speak for me. Okay, so, you know, you can take it or leave it, basically. I don't claim any authority other than I have a technical background for studying the information that I'm, you know, showing you tonight. Some of it is very easy to, you don't need a technical background to see it, as you'll see. Okay, so a quick review of events before 9/11. Previous false flag plans. False flag equals commit an atrocity and blame it on someone else and frame them. Starts in the playground. You know, he did it. He did it, miss. You know, he kicked the ball through the window. It wasn't me. It's what they've done with 9/11 with the Muslims. Everyone's probably heard of this, or most people have probably heard of this. Project for the New American Century. This group published a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses in the year 2000, and it states on page 2 that PNAC is a project to promote American global leadership. Okay, and you can download this document off the internet, the whole thing. On page 63, it says, the process of transformation of the US military, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And for people that have studied 9/11, this is probably one of the first phrases that they come across. And quite a few people have heard of this document, although questions have been raised about this more recently. An author called James Bamford, and I think it was either just before or just after 9/11, I think it was year 2000, 2001, possibly late 2001, he uncovered a previously classified evidence of a planned false flag operation called Operation Northwoods. This was a plan to rally support for an attack on Cuba by creating a staged attack on American citizens and blame it on Cuba. But was this released to get people to think in terms of remote-controlled planes and drones? Because that's what it talks about. James Bamford doesn't really speak about 9/11 despite talking about stuff like this. Certainly somebody I know commented that this document seems to have some inconsistencies in the language. For example, they use the word holiday instead of vacation. Now, I don't know what the, you know, I've done a lot of analysis of that, but it's just a peculiar thing which I think, you know, you'll see how that meshes into what I'm going to tell you later on. Now, the first thing to point out that on 9/11 were three buildings were destroyed. Last week we had another BBC travesty of a documentary where they talked about the third building 7, to go down, which wasn't hit by anything. A lot of people are saying that's controlled demolition. I don't think it was controlled demolition. But I'm not going to talk about World Trade Center 7 much. I've got some pictures, but not the focus of this. Actually, the whole of the World Trade Center complex was destroyed. All buildings which had a WTC prefix were destroyed. Some of them were left standing a bit, like World Trade Center 6 and 4. 6 was left sort of standing with a big hole in the middle. But these two, Towers 1 and 2, were completely destroyed. Now, is that a building collapsing? You hear this collapse. World Trade Center collapsed. It collapsed. I said it for probably 4 or 5 years. I'll still say it. I'll probably say it tonight without thinking it. You know, this idea, collapse, it's put into your head by repetition, like so many other things. Now, Judy Wood was able to get around this idea of collapse. She said it's turning to dust. It's dustifying. Now, you know, I've got a degree in computer science and physics. Do I need to have that to tell you that that building is turning to dust, or can you see it for yourself? Now, I'm not asking, you know, I'm not going to take a vote or anything. That's a rhetorical question. It's turning to dust. We'll come back to this. Let's see if this works. Yeah, it's just a little sequence. This is called the spire. This will run twice. We're going to see this two or three times tonight. 70 stories high. What's happening to it? Is it turning to dust, or is it burning up? Is it turning to dust? Is it just falling down? What's it doing? Turning to dust. Some people disagree. Now, that's up to them. Steel girders. Well, I'm saying it's steel girders. Well, stop me. No, what is it? What is it? Is it wood? Is it glass? Is it steel? Is it office chairs? Is it toilets? What is it? Looks like steel to me, because we know that there was a steel core in the building. And also, I'm just going to briefly talk about Building 7 here. Now, the thing that Judy Wood has pointed out that not many people have really, it's a very neat demolition. Very, very neat. And it was actually, if it was controlled demolition, Building 7 was 100 feet taller than the tallest building ever taken down with controlled demolition before in history. And there you can see it's barely across the street. See? There's a gap there. 47 story building. Barely across the street. It's a pretty good job. 6 seconds. Gone. I'm not going to play the film because that's been played over and over. I know this PowerPoint is going to crash at some point, so if it does, please forgive me for fiddling around with it to get it going again. Now then, where's the rubble? Now then, this is a key picture. This is probably one of the most important pictures to do with 9/11 research, I think. We call it intermission. That's the name we've given to it. The reason why we call it intermission is Towers 1 and 2 are gone. But we know that that's Tower 7. And we know that Tower 7 went down at 5:20 in the evening. Or 5:22 or something. I can't remember the exact time. It's given us 5:20, 5:30, 5:22, 5:18. So we know that that's on 9/11. That picture was taken maybe 2 in the afternoon, something like that. And let's just see if this animation works. That's the rubble pile from two towers. Now that, I think it's either 6 or 8 stories. I can't remember. This is from Judy's presentation, this picture. So you can see the comparison there. Where's it gone? China? By 2 o'clock? Went to China by 2? Okay. You know, if you want to accept that as the reason that Giuliani and he got all the trucks ready and they carried all that 500 miles of steel. I calculated the total length of steel in the World Trade Center laid end to end. The horizontal and vertical sections of steel. 550 miles of steel. I've got a little article about that in the booklet, how I calculated it. It's easy to work out. If you can do basic maths, you can work it out yourself. So how I became involved. Quick run through. Late 2003, became suspicious. Woke up 2004. Did a small film showing two people turned up at a local pub. I wrote letters to MPs when all these terrorism laws were starting to come in. I saw Jimmy Walter and William Rodriguez May 2005, organised a Shayla Mashon event in Derby where I've come up from, 2005 December. That went off quite well. I joined Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December 2005, and I organised 2 William Rodriguez events in February 2007, one in Derby, one in Birmingham. I've been on the local radio about 3 times, just short things, nothing significant really. I also got a 9/11 article actually published in, I work part-time for the Open University, tutor on a course. And I actually got an article published in the Faculty magazine thanks to a contact there. And I believe, I could be wrong, it's the only 9/11 article published in any university, UK university publication, I think. I can't swear to that. I've got a copy of that article at the back. It's all on the internet, so you can go to the OU website and find it. That's all linked from my website if you want to find it. I've given out loads of discs. I've got a load there, so come and get them. Blah, blah. So that's what I've been doing. And in terms of the sort of scientific type of thing, or technical, this was a summary of what I've done. We'll skip through this quite quickly. It's just to show you that it's there. You know, there's a bit of maths. But basically, it's the free-fall argument. You can tell just by looking at the destruction, this wasn't a normal destruction. And I first saw this in George Humphrey's film, so I worked it out myself, this little calculation. Towers were at approximately 1,350 feet, actually 1,362 and 68. One towel went in about 10 seconds, the other in about 8 or 9 seconds, and so they're recorded. Now, if you look at the construction, again, think of the justification. How did that happen? This was the construction. 47 interior columns, 236 exterior columns, gone, 10 seconds. Pancake collapse. Well, that's what the BBC tell you. This is a pancake collapse. Melting steel caused trusses in the building to weaken. Steel beam softened and building underwent a pancake collapse. Collapse again, you see. That word. Each floor fell onto the next, and the increasing weight of the floors caused a catastrophic structural failure. Now, what we've got here is something that's factually incorrect. You can go and look it up in the textbook. And that's still on the BBC website. Steel melts at 1500 degrees centigrade. But we're not going to talk about melting steel. A lot of people want to talk about that. But there's no heat. There's no heat. We had a dust cloud that came past people. They coughed a bit and they didn't get burnt. There's virtually no fire once the towers had collapsed. There's no heat to melt that steel. And I'll come on to why. There wasn't. We can say safely there wasn't any heat. But there were some fires. So this is just a very quick run through some of the sort of equations, to do the equations of motion. Law of falling bodies, which is from Galileo, and the law of gravity, Isaac Newton, 300 years ago. Distance travelled s is equal to the initial velocity u multiplied by the travel time t, added to half of the acceleration a multiplied by the square of the travel time. That's s equals ut plus half at squared, which I learnt when I was about, about 15, 16, something like that, in school. And then we can say that the initial velocity is zero because the object that started falling at the top of the towers was stationary when it started. So you just get, instead of it being ut, that becomes zero, so it's s equals half at squared. In considering the twin towers, we want to find out how long it would take for an object, e.g. a ball bearing, drop from the top of the towers to reach the ground. We then compare this time to the measured time for the quote-unquote collapse. We have to use that word again. We rearrange our previous equation so that we can find out what t would be if we knew all the other values, and it comes out as this. T equals square root of 2s over 8. So the distance that the ball bearing would travel is 1,350 feet approximately, and that's 411.48 metres. A is the acceleration due to Earth's gravity, which is 9.81 metres per second squared. And that gives us a way of calculating t, which gives you 9.16 seconds. So we know that the towers came down at very close to the rate of free fall. In other words, as I think Erich Hoffmeister said, it's not possible for the towers to have come down through themselves as it is through the air, because they had all that structure to resist the collapse. So that's basically what she said. So anyway, so that's really, that type of thing was what got me into this scholars group. Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And as somebody in the audience here pointed out to me, his suspicions were aroused with this symbol, the torch. So I sort of had that in the side of my mind, even though I was hopeful that it didn't mean what he said it did, but I think it turned out he was right. After the physics forum thread, because I posted that I just showed you the maths on a physics forum, which is supposedly frequented by people who are familiar with those sorts of things. You know, I don't expect everyone in the audience to have followed that. It was just purely an illustration. And that thread ran to 900 pages and something like 5,000 responses on that thread before they closed it. I can't remember the exact figures. It's still on there. If you can go and look at it if you Google it and stuff. So following that, December 2005, I got an email from Professor Stephen E. Jones inviting me to join this Scholars for 9/11 Truth group. And I sort of said, oh, well, you know, yeah, I can join, but, you know, I'm only a part-time tutor for the Open University. I haven't really got any, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a professor, I've only got a lowly graduate's degree, bachelor's degree. So I got involved with the Scholars group, emailed Steve Jones, I helped him with a couple of video clips, there were a couple of other people doing that. I've put a lot of this video material together myself that you'll see shortly. I've got some videos to show you. And so on. And I got in touch with Kevin Ryan, who is the guy who was fired from Underwriters Laboratories. I converted his PowerPoint presentation into a Google video for him. things like that. And I assumed that scholars for 9/11 truth would gain some traction of thinking, oh yeah, we've got some scholars on the go now. Things are going to start happening. Steve Jones published his paper, Why Indeed Did the Twin Towers Collapse? Collapse, that word again. November 2005. A few revisions were made. I made a couple of small comments. But I thought this Jones guy was an honest guy. Posted a few other articles. This Jim Fetz, a guy who you'll hear a bit more about. He was the co-founder of the scholars group. Jim Fetz has done a lot of research into the Kennedy assassination. He's written books on that. I thought Jim Fetz was a good guy. I would like to think he's a good guy now, but unfortunately I can't. Works such as Dr. Judy Wood's billiard ball example, which was kind of like a more sophisticated version of what I've just shown you, with more illustrations and more kind of meat behind it to beef it up. Her work was also published in June-July 2005, and it was actually presented at an engineering conference in June 2006. And then Morgan Reynolds came on the scene with his paper, We Have Some Holes in the Plane Stories. That was also, I think, early 2006 that he first posted that. And that was about this question about the holes in the World Trade Center being the wrong width for the planes, this sort of thing. Now, what started to happen in the scholars group is I started posting stuff. I was getting to know a few of the people. But I noticed there was this very big argument going on about this, what happened to the planes at the World Trade Center, and Morgan Reynolds' piece about how these holes were too big for the planes or too small, I can't remember which way around it was, and all these sorts of things. And I hadn't really studied his paper yet, I just hadn't had time, I was caught up in other things. And also Judy Wood's BBE, billiard ball example, that also wasn't really discussed very much. And at first I sort of thought, well, you know, it doesn't really matter because, you know, we're just trying to show that 9/11 is an inside job and we've got to get the public to understand that because, you know, the BBC is not telling us the truth. So I didn't really make such a big deal of it. And, you know, people say this to me now, why is it important? You know, who cares whether, you know, it's planes or no planes? We know that Bush is responsible. You know, that's the thing we've got to get across to people. That's the key thing. Well, I've changed my mind now. So what I want to talk about now for a couple of minutes is examples of media fakery. Do the media deliberately broadcast fake information? Let's see if this works.
U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush pushes for a land war against Iraq. But polls show the U.S. public is split 50-50 on that idea. Then comes this eyewitness testimony before a congressional committee from a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl. The claim is she cannot be identified for fear of reprisals.
Why is there a set of Iraqi soldiers coming to the hospital with guns? They took the babies out of incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The U.S. public is outraged. The result? Support for land war zooms. It's a turning point. Desert Storm is launched. 135,000 Iraqis are killed. An estimated 1 million Iraqis, many of them children and old people, then die as a result of 10 years of sanctions. One small problem. There never were any incubator baby deaths. Not one. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's investigative flagship program, The Fifth Estate, reveals the girl to be the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, given her lines and coached in acting by the giant American PR firm Hill & Knowlton. It's one phase in a $10 million joint U.S.-Kuwaiti campaign of deception. This man is lying.
I myself buried 14 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators.
This man is lying.
They had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
There were a lot of people who participated in a conspiracy. Yes, an out-and-out conspiracy.
Okay. And the next one that not as many people have heard of is that. I think quite a lot of people have heard of that one, pretty blatant. Zapruder film. John Costella, who actually also turns out to be a different person to who I thought he was, have closely analysed the film taken by Abraham Zapruder of the JFK assassination. And as everyone else, I assumed that the film was genuine. This film was not released until 1964. You know the film when I put it on. It's less than 500 frames in this film. It's only about a couple of minutes long or something. Costello documents at least 6 mistakes in this film that was released. And here's 2 of them. The fast-forward mistakes, we have an observation where people in the clip break the laws of physics, those laws of physics, or bodily motion. And mistake A occurs when Mrs. Connolly snaps her head to the rear too far too rapidly. Just before she does, she turns her head to the right, to the front, in a more realistic motion. This might look fast, but compare it to the head snaps of the Secret Service driver of the limousine. These have been analysed scientifically and have shown to be twice as fast as humanly possible, even for an athlete trying to do it as quickly as possible. So if you look where the yellow arrows are pointing in the lower 2 pictures, you'll see that these movements are actually physically impossible to make. I'll leave that up just for a few seconds for people to be comfortable that they've seen it. Just watch where the 2 arrows are pointing after the clip's paused for a minute. Physically impossible to move heads that fast. Okay? Another mistake. The wound mistake. The Zapruder film is telling us that the whole front top of JFK's head gets blasted away. There's a huge crater where his forehead used to be, through which his wife can be seen. This would make sense if he was indeed hit by a high-velocity rifle bullet from behind. The only problem is that this. Everyone who saw the president after the shooting said that his face was not injured or damaged at all. JFK autopsy photographs surfaced in the late 80s and showed his face to be completely intact. Even the sceptics had to agree that either the Zapruder film or the autopsy photos or both have to be forgeries. Okay? So we've got an example there of media fakery. They deliberately made a fake film and put it out about a year after the Kennedy assassination. Why did they do that? Why would they put out a fake film like that? Anybody got any guesses? Well, part of it's to mask the real truth and where the shooting really took place. But also, one of the key things which they did, and I didn't really make it clear with what I showed you there, is that some of you read about this may know that the witnesses in Dealey Plaza said, car came in, slowed down to a stop, Kennedy was shot, the driver put his foot down, and off the car went. If you watch that as a Zapruder film, it shows the car in continuous motion. The reason being that they deleted some of the frames. They deleted some of the frames from the version that they released. And that thereby discredited all those witnesses who said that the car stopped. Their testimony instantly became unreliable because the camera never lies, right? Okay, so now we're going to the plane fakery issue, mainly at the World Trade Center. Pentagon's different, Shanksville's different. We don't really have that many witnesses to a plane at Shanksville. The witness stories at Pentagon are much more confused. But some people say, no big bones at the World Trade Center? Ridiculous. I recently read this in a book by Laura Knight Yadsick, about page 93. Most sincere 9/11 researchers agree planes crashed at the World Trade Center. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm an insincere 9/11 researcher, folks. I stopped reading that book at page 93, and I've not really got the will to read it anymore. You'll probably find out why soon, hopefully. But we all saw planes hit. We saw it on the videos, didn't we? Lots of them. We saw the Norday footage, didn't come out until the day afterwards. First impact. One of only about 3 places in New York where they could have filmed it, that footage. We saw multiple videos of the second impact. Lots of them. All the people had their own video cameras rolling. What are you saying? What am I saying, everyone? Computer graphics? Holograms? Never believe the public, you know. I'm damaging the truth campaign. Sorry. That's the basic argument against what I'm telling you. And there are other things too, of course. I'm simplifying it a bit. But that's the thrust of what a lot of it is said. So let's have a look at the evidence. Evidence, evidence, evidence. My website, check the evidence. Not check the conspiracy theory, check the evidence. A reminder, to find the truth, we have to keep looking at the evidence. We should always be on the lookout for new evidence, new studies. We should check it, when possible, against known physical laws and established data. So in the words of no ordinary genius, Richard Feynman, what does the data say? Well, let's have a look, shall we? This might be a bit loud, so I might have to see if there's one. 4 minutes. Okay, so the problem there is there's an explosion after the plane enters the building. Now you go and try and debate that on the internet, and people say, oh, the plane was travelling so fast it created a vacuum and the fuel was sucked in so it didn't ignite before, you know, blah, 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 blah. No. If you have a lot of petrol or kerosene and a huge impact like that, you're going to get a fireball. Now, if that was the only evidence that no planes hit the World Trade Center, then, you know, you could be forgiven for sort of trying to debate it, but of course the story doesn't end there. We're now going to look at the video I referred to in that. It's another quick video. It's a bit of a mishmash there. Somebody else did this one. It's about the second impact live shot. Let's see if I can get this up. Is this going to crash on me? Oh, that looks like it might work. Here we go. Oops, let's just try that again. Give me a sec. Here we go. That's basically it. There's a bit more to that, but that's a bit I wanted to show you. In other words, the live shot of the second World Trade Center impact was filmed by Fox TV with a military camera system, Westcam. Okay, look at this. Anyone remember the passport story? Guy's passport that survived, landed on the pavement. Well, how come, excuse me, but, hello, how come that rubber tire looks pretty well inflated? The one on the left is obviously not inflated, it's cut in half. Survives a huge impact of those two planes. Does anyone have a problem with that? I certainly have a problem with that. Now, you know, I'm not talking about physics or, you know, technical science. I have a problem with that in the same way I have a problem with this passport story. And that's the evidence that the government has offered to say that a plane crashed at the World Trade Center, or one of them. About this one, you're probably not going to see this one. It's picked up by Judy Wood. This was dated 25th of October 2001, this picture. Top of World Trade Center 5. We're going to come to these features here later. But this thing here. Was this planted? If you look at this, I've tried to label the sections here. This is from a satellite picture on the right here. And you can actually see some of these pieces because it's in the same place. You can see I've tried to line them up. But this was taken before the 25th of October. The picture on the right, the blurred one. Looks like that was put there sometime in between 9/11 and the 25th of October. Planted piece of fuselage. Now this is a good one as well. How can aluminium and light materials crash through solid steel girders? Purdue University have done a lovely study, a nice computer animation, showing these, you know, quarter-inch aluminium wing struts slicing through these steel girders. Sorry, but that's not possible. And the only analogy I can give you, well, I can give you lots of analogies, but one of them is, what would happen if you fired a 0.44 Magnum bullet, according to Dirty Harry, the most powerful handgun in the world, at a steel girder? Now, you've got a lead bullet, which is denser and flying faster than a Boeing. What would it do if you fired that at a steel girder? Might make a bit of a, yeah, it'd ricochet. It'd make a bit of a dent in it, a bit of a mark, but it ain't going to go through it. So how can a plane wing go through it? Forget about the engines. You can clearly see these girders all slice through. Not possible. Not possible. Whatever people tell you on the internet, think of the hard, you know, get an aluminium stick. Go to metal dealers. Sheet metal worker, get some aluminium, get a lump of steel, hit it against it as hard as you can. What comes off worst? The aluminium, every time. Doesn't matter how fast it travels. Boeings cannot travel at 540 miles an hour at sea level. The air is too thick. That's the official speed of impact of one of the planes, 540. Not possible for them to travel at that speed. Sorry? 240, I've heard 320, I think. It's not possible. Can you see a plane inside? No plane parts hanging out, no tail, no engines, no wing, you know, wing bits, nothing. It would bounce off, it cannot penetrate. If the military could penetrate structures with Boeings, why did they ever bother to use depleted uranium, which is known for its penetrating power? because of its density and its hardness. You just use a Boeing. If you can do that to steel structures, you just use a Boeing. Much cheaper. You know, you get them second hand as well. You know, EasyJet when they finish with them or whatever. Just fire a few of them at Iraq, you know. Utter devastation. I made my point, I think. Now then. But all the witnesses, they saw them, everyone. They all saw planes. Come on, you're lying to me, Andrew. You're just making this up. You're just, you know, it's just your ego at work here, man. You've got a problem with your ego. The witnesses all saw it. Well, what I did was, and this is, I can count this as my bit of original research. I came to understand that in 2005, 500 witness accounts were released under a Freedom of Information Act. And I've got all this on my website. I'll quickly go through the details. I managed to establish that at least 96 witnesses were near the World Trade Center within half a mile. These are the first responders, the emergency workers, police, firemen, emergency medical technicians. 500 accounts I went through using keyword search. And a total of 117 witnesses I found who were at or near the World Trade Center buildings at the time of second impact. Basically, I looked at the accounts. I looked for where they said, we parked our vehicle at Vesey Street, West Street, Church Street, whatever. Looked how close they were to the actual World Trade Center buildings. And I included those accounts in my study. 19 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center actually reported seeing the second impact. This is all to do with the second impact, because obviously the first one, people didn't know what was going on. It was obviously the second one where they should have known what was going on. A lot of interesting things have come out of this study, and I could do another study on it. There's so much stuff in these witness accounts. Only 20% of witnesses saw the second plane. And only 20 witnesses near the World Trade Center reported actually hearing the plane. Only 8 of the witnesses near the World Trade Center actually reported seeing and hearing the plane. And these are the people who were actually there, on the ground, you know, fixing people, pulling people out. Those are the people that were there, not people who are on television, you know, people's friend, you know, all this. Now, Jim Fetzer, who was a co-founder of the Scholars Group, he complimented me on this study. I went on his radio program. I got all that on my website and everything. He thought it was good. Thought I'd done a good job. Other people thought I'd done a good job. But he'd probably not heard about this study very much. And two particular accounts I'll give you just here quickly, sections of. Scott Hollowatch. He was stood next to Chief Ganshi. Ganshi, I don't know how to pronounce it. Hollowatch is saying, he was like, no, 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 we have another explosion. I said, no, Chief, I witnessed it. I watched the plane hit the other tower. He's like, are you sure? I said, Chief, I'm 100% positive I watched the second plane hit the tower. Two guys stood next to each other. They can't agree that the plane hit the tower. They stood next to each other. Firefighter David Sandvik. Page 4. I never heard the motor of the plane, the sound of the engines. Where was he? We just heard the explosion. You felt the explosion. And looking straight up, seeing the fireball you see on your news. But where underneath it? We're looking up at it. He's right under it. Never heard the plane. How's that? How is that? Now, I'll just pause a minute at this point and say, I don't think large Boeing, in fact, I know large Boeings didn't hit the World Trade Center towers. But that doesn't mean to say I can tell you what did hit, because I can't. I can't tell you that. All I can tell you is that large Boeings did not hit the World Trade Center. And they weren't remote controlled or, you know, have pods. It didn't work. And there's a lot more than this. I've just given you two. There are quite a few more. And you could probably find some of these for yourself if you went to look. Okay. Just the point at the bottom there, if the planes did indeed crash, then all the video evidence should match perfectly. Especially that from main news outlets. We don't have any video from the main news outlets, from their own cameramen, that I know of. It's all amateur shots. The two main ones being Evan Fairbanks and Michael Herzakhani, who was the one that I did the He Won't Get Fooled Again. That was his film. That wasn't an official, it said CNN on it, but it wasn't one of their official cameramen. It was an amateur film. So this is the second impact, remember, when all the world news media were on the scene. No one's got a good video of the plane coming in. And yeah, precisely. If you look into it, you'll find all these strange things. So, if there were no plane crashes at all, anywhere, which I think is correct, we know, everyone queries the plane at the Pentagon, most people would say it's a missile. I'm not sure if there's a missile or what it was, but if there are no planes at all involved in 9/11, no real planes, means no hijackers. It explains the anomalies of the passenger list, which is also very difficult. You can't get a passenger list very easily if you try. I know people that have tried that and you get conflicting passenger lists. One was released, then another one was released. There was no stand down. All this talk you hear about stand down, it's just, you know, noise. There's nothing to it. It explains the flight anomalies quite well. Callum Douglas has done a study with Flight 77 data, and he came to the conclusion that it had to be faked, because the flight NTSB flight data said that the plane didn't go below 180 feet off the ground. But if no plane hit the Pentagon, that's true. That would add up. It explains the surviving hijackers, because there weren't any hijackers, so they all survived, because there were no hijackers involved. It explains the fake NORAD tapes, because they were known to have been fake. That came out, David Ray Griffin did that study, that was about 18 months ago. He said, these NORAD tapes must be fake because of what they were saying on them. Well, if there were no planes, they must have had to have faked the NORAD tapes for the plane stories to have some kind of substance to them. Operators were watching radar blips. The operators didn't actually see the planes physically. And if they have, they haven't given any witness testimony under oath, to my knowledge. And it indicates another layer of cover-up. David Ray Griffin talks about planes. Steve Jones talks about planes. Most 9/11 researchers talk about planes at the World Trade Center. They'll probably agree plane wasn't involved at the Pentagon. And the key DVD that I've got back there, copies of, or you can watch it on the internet, September Clues, that's the study which will show you this. The stand down was where they said that because the planes weren't intercepted, they should have been shot down due to the rules. If a plane is off course for more than, 45 minutes or 15 minutes, it should be intercepted to see what's happening and shot down if it poses a risk to property or life or whatever. And so the theory is in the 9/11 truth community that the military must have been ordered not to shoot the planes down, because they actually hit the World Trade Center. There was a sufficient delay of time for them, the later planes to be shot down, but they weren't shot down. So somebody in the military must have given an order for them not to be shot down. In other words, a stand down. So here's my view of what might have happened with the 9/11 plane issue. Quite a number of military exercises were going on, according to people like Webster Tarpley. I think it's 15 different military exercises involving planes were going on, which is probably true. I think that could well be true. Some general or military high-up dude rings up and says to somebody high up in the command structure, there's four planes that have been hijacked. Planes are in the air, get on it. NORAD, the FAA, and everyone spend 1 or 2 hours looking for them, but they're not there. There's no real planes. All they can see is fake radar blips for these military exercises that are going on. Nothing is scrambled because there's no planes to intercept. So they don't know where to send these interceptor planes. It's not a stand down. There's just no targets for them to actually intercept. No real targets. Everyone feels bad because the non-existent planes have managed to destroy the World Trade Center part of the Pentagon. How can that happen? No one will admit to anything because it's a huge cock-up. None of the military, none of the FAA will admit to anything, because somebody has injected a false story into the system. A false story so blatantly false that everyone believes it. And few realise what did the damage at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. So the myth begins. And we're going to say what did the damage to the World Trade Center. And this is a very important point. The media are fully complicit. They know, some of them know, that they had to be involved with this to pull off the 9/11 illusion. So the media are as guilty as Bush. The Fox TV executives are as guilty as Bush. BBC TV executives are as guilty as Bush. Okay? I won't bother reading all that out. It's a short time. Right, so we're 9:05 now. It's probably reached a good breaking point, and we'll go on to the next section after the break. Okay.